This is an ABC podcast.
Gabrielle Jackson is an editor with Guardian Australia. A few years ago, she decided to write a personal story about a health condition she'd struggled with since she was a teenager. Gabrielle began the article with these words: "I feel sad that this is the hardest story I've ever written, and that I'm embarrassed that people will read it and know the intimate details of my life." Gabrielle was writing about her endometriosis. Thousands of women got in touch with The Guardian with their own experiences of endo after that article. And what came up again and again, regardless of where a woman lived, how old she was, how rich or poor, was that women with endometriosis commonly wait for years to get a diagnosis and are often not believed by doctors when they seek help for their pain. In looking into the treatment of endo, Gabrielle has cracked open a big story about women's health. Her book is called Pain and Prejudice. Hi, Gabrielle.
Hi, Sarah.
Looking back, when were you first hit with the symptoms of endometriosis?
It really started in my teenage years, to be honest. Probably from the time of about 14, I would have really bad period pain, and this pain that went down into my legs, and they would feel really heavy, and then I would have really bad back pain. And, you know, I was that girl in the sick bay every month, and my mum was picking me up from school month after month.
And so what did you put that pain down to as a teenager?
Well, I didn't know. Eventually, I was diagnosed when I was 17 with chronic fatigue syndrome. Looking back now at the criteria and knowing other people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, I don't think I did have it. But studies now show that women with endometriosis are 180 times more likely to report chronic fatigue syndrome than other women. So, you know, I think that was probably, I understand now that fatigue, that incredible bout of fatigue I was having at the time I was diagnosed with that, is actually just a symptom of my endo.
Did other women or friends or teachers say, "Oh, look, it's just period pain, Gabrielle"?
Oh, yeah.
This is what happens.
Yeah. My female GP told me constantly, "Look, some women have bad period pain. That's life. You know, put up with it."
What accident did you have at 19 that, you know, further complicated, I guess, the symptoms you were feeling?
Yes. So I was a typical stupid 19-year-old and went skiing for the first time and thought I was just brilliant and decided to go off a jump, like on my third day of ever skiing in my life. I had accidentally swapped a ski with a friend, which I didn't know, and I hit a bit of rocky snow and the ski just fell off. And so then I was ploughing down this hill and I ran into a rock. I just hit my back, came into contact with this big rock, and I somersaulted in the air and kind of fell on my back, and I didn't know, but blood was streaming down through the snow. And anyway, I ended up having a compound fracture of my sacrum.
Ow.
Which is that triangle bone at the base of your spine.
And so, of course, that's going to leave someone in pain. Did that sort of become the explanation for some of the pain
Yes,
you were feeling?
Absolutely. So I then blamed all my back and hip pain and this pain down the front of my right leg, which seems to have accompanied me my whole life. All of that just got blamed on that skiing accident. And that's what I would tell physiotherapists, and that's what I would tell doctors about.
So how did you finally get diagnosed with endometriosis?
So I just realised that no one else suffered from their periods like I did. So I would have vomiting and diarrhea every month, incredible headaches. I just couldn't leave my bed. It was incredible. And I just said to my GP, "I don't actually think this is normal. And I really want a referral to a gynecologist, please." And she reluctantly gave me one.
And did that gynecologist, how could they tell? Was it just by talking to you about your symptoms?
Within 5 minutes of me talking, you know, he just said, "Tell me about your life," basically. Within 5 minutes, he said, "I think you have endometriosis." This is the thing. A lot of people keep saying, "Oh, the symptoms are very generalized. You know, it's very hard to diagnose." Well, it's not if you listen. if you know what you're talking about. It's actually not that difficult.
Is there anything clinical that a gynecologist or a doctor does to formalise that diagnosis?
So endometriosis can only be officially diagnosed at laparoscopy.
So that's in a surgical procedure?
Yeah, a surgical procedure, that's right. But some endometriosis can be seen on some other tests. So if you have endometriomas, which are cysts in the ovaries, endometrial cysts in the ovaries, that can sometimes be seen at pelvic ultrasound. MRI can show adenomyosis, which is another disease like endometriosis, but that's in the muscle wall of the uterus. That can be seen on an MRI.
So what is it? What exactly is happening in your body if you've got endometriosis?
So with endometriosis, that's when parts of the endometrium, which is the lining of the womb, that grows outside the uterus, mostly in the pelvic areas, but it's been found in the lungs. Actually, they think in the lungs and diaphragm system is more common than they once thought. Even has been found in some people's brains. And so what happens there is that endometrial tissue reacts, you know, it bleeds when you are menstruating, and it forms cysts and adhesions, and sometimes people's organs can all become stuck together from this material.
So it follows the same cycle as your uterus does. When your hormones send out messages each month that it's time to bleed, that tissue, wherever it is in your body, thinks that's what has to happen to
that's
it.
That's what they believe. But wow. There's still a lot more research that needs to be done on endometriosis, yes.
So once you got that diagnosis at 23, mm-hmm. did that immediately change things for you? Was life suddenly easier after that?
So I was really lucky that this doctor referred me to a gynecologist who was a specialist in endometriosis. He was very knowledgeable, and he was also a really skilled laparoscopic excision surgeon. So there's lots of there's various ways that doctors can get rid of endometriosis, but excision has now been found by all the studies as the best, and that just means they actually cut it out. Some people use lasers to get rid of it.
So wherever it's growing on those other parts
yeah.
of your body.
And also it's really hard to see, so unless you are trained, sometimes you'll just get the most obvious endometriosis lesions, and if you're not really skilled in understanding what endo can look like, they might leave behind some others. But I had this really great surgeon, and he was a very caring doctor actually too, and he did a great surgery. So my periods were great for a long time after that. And he did explain to me that it could grow back as well.
What about your pain? So was all that resolved in the wake of that surgery?
So that kind of pain and nausea that I had with my periods was really much better after that. I would still get pain, but would not interrupt my life as it had before. What I didn't realise is all the other symptoms I had. You know, I still had the back pain, which I'd always put down to my skiing accident. Still had this leg pain. Still have these bouts of fatigue that would, you know, sometimes last a few weeks and then just go away. I would really suffer from, you know, everyone gets busy and then gets tired, but I'd seem to pay for my, you know, bouts of energy more than I saw other people around me.
How did it start affecting your sense of yourself, Gabrielle? Like, did you start to think, God, am I just weak? Or like, why is this going on? Why am I in bed while my friends seem to be able to party all night and still get up and go to work?
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. I thought of myself as a weak person, and I started to joke about being a hypochondriac because I didn't want it to be something people said behind my back. And, you know, I look back now and I could not ever stay in a job because I would end up just so exhausted. You know, I would be in a job for a year or 2 years and then I'd leave and I'd have a few months off. And yeah, as I said, I never saw my friends suffer. I would be doing the same things as them, but they weren't suffering in the same way. So I just thought of myself as this really weak kind of second-rate person.
You still forged ahead with your career, and you were living overseas and went to India in 2012. What were you doing in India?
I became quite obsessed with kebabs. I loved kebabs. All sorts of kebabs. Souvlaki, gyros, you know, doner kebab, kofta kebab. And I just thought, I'm going to write a book about where kebabs came from. Because then I discovered, you know, like in some parts of Turkey and other parts of the Middle East, kebabs are a really important festive occasion and you go out for them. It's a big deal.
And when you've had a good kebab, you realise that what you've been buying after, you know, a big night out in a van is not a proper kebab.
Exactly. So I decided to research kebabs.
So did kebabs come from India?
Well, no. They came from the Middle East and probably from the time where the, you know, Persian Empire was in India. So I was there. I wanted to go to a place called Lucknow.
You're doing deep kebab research.
Deep kebab research. Oh, God, it was fantastic. But, yes.
And what happened to you in Mumbai
on
that trip?
So the day I actually arrived in India, I'd met some people at the guest house I was staying with, and we decided to get a train into the centre of Mumbai. And you know, everyone's seen these pictures of the Indian trains with people, you know, hanging out and no doors. I tried to get on, but there just didn't seem to be anywhere to get on. So I was running from one door to the other in thongs, never a good idea. And then the train started leaving the platform, and this woman I was with, I thought, was saying to me, "Get on, jump on." And I don't remember, but I obviously stupidly did try to jump on the train as it was leaving, and I must have fallen in the gap between the train and the platform, and I had this sense of being like kind of tossed around in a washing machine, you know, this back and forth, bang,
so
bang, bang.
You fell between the platform,
and the
rail,
train. Yeah.
And the train was moving over
so,
you.
The first thing I remember is people yelling, hearing voices yelling out, don't move, stay still. And I thought, oh, I better not move in case they're talking to me, because I was about to sit up. But then I opened my eyes and there was a train kind of over the top of me. I was flat on my back. I don't know how I got there. And then this train was travelling over the top of me, and I just thought, oh, this is it. I'm dead. Like, there's no way to survive this.
How did you?
I don't know. By some amazing luck. But I remember people jumped down. So
the train passed all the way.
And I had to wait. I was at the first carriage, I should say. So the train felt very long. I don't know how long
it was. You could just hear it coming over you.
Yes.
And was it touching your body at all?
No. It wasn't touching my body. But I kept thinking, something's going to be hanging down.
Oh,
is there a ladder at the end of the train that's going to just take me out? But then people jumped down and like, obviously everyone thought I was dead. The woman told me, oh, my God, I thought you were dead for sure, or at least had lost a leg. And then people on the platform were, like, touching me. I think I was some kind of good luck totem. But, yeah.
So you were pulled up from the train track, and what shape were you in physically?
Yeah, so a terrible shape, but I didn't quite realise at first, you know, what was happening. You know, I was so confused, and I just remember touching my face and then looking at my hands, and they were covered in blood, and then I looked down, and it was just blood all over me, and kind of, I'd been in a puddle, so I was wet with dirt and muck, and thinking, oh, God, if I don't have a broken hip, because my hip and shoulder were incredibly sore and my whole right arm. But I thought, oh, my God, if I don't die from that, I'm going to die from a wound in being infected.
And what kind of injuries did it leave you
with? So I had lots of cuts and scrapes and bruises. I had a broken shoulder and some torn ligaments and, a bit of a head injury, which thankfully didn't do any permanent damage.
How did your family back home in Australia respond when you ring them from India and say, I've just been run over by a train?
Well, I didn't tell anyone. Every time I thought I remembered that moment of being under the train, I would become so panicked and think, I can't be alive. Maybe I'm not alive. I mean, it makes me sound like a crazy person to say this, but I thought it's just better not to think about it, because then I'm definitely alive. So I just didn't tell anyone. And I thought, oh, well, I'm in India. Where better to face life and the mysteries of life and death?
I'm surprised I'm not reading like an Eat, Pray, Love book from you out of this, Gabrielle.
I know, right?
So your body had been through some really extreme stuff by what, your mid-20s by that stage,
mid-30s.
How did the pain of that accident, of being run over by a train, how did that compare with what you were living with day by day, month by month with endo? How do they compare?
I think the it was really good for me to have those different types of pain, because when I had the train accident and the skiing accident, no one doubted my pain. No one thought I was hysterical. They believed me. They were like, oh yeah, we can see that bone poking through your skin. That's painful, and we can help you. But I knew that my other pain felt just as bad and sometimes worse, because I also had this sick feeling. I mean, the nausea is just, you know, so hard to overcome. And this brain fog that you get, that you, I've described it as kind of looking through driving with a dirty windscreen and smudged glasses. You can't think as clearly as you should be able to. And that is much harder to cope with than the pain of a broken bone.
How much do you think you've spent on your medical treatments connected with endo, say up to that point in your mid-30s?
Oh, a lot. I can tell you now, I came back from London with a house deposit and I've spent it all on my health.
And what kinds of things?
So I chose to have to choose my surgeon for the last operation I had, and I had to have two surgeons, the gynecologist and a colorectal
surgeon.
So
this is, you had initial surgery, yes. But then is it common for endo patients to have further surgery?
Yes. That's a whole other issue, because some surgeons, some gynecologists operate over multiple times, which actually now we know can cause more pain. I've only had two excision surgeries, which have been really helpful for me.
So that's one big lot of funds there in surgery.
Yes. And I've got to say, my surgeon actually didn't, most of the kind of, I was $10,000 out of pocket for one surgery, and most of it didn't go to him. He treats a lot of endo patients and really is careful about how much he charges. But these things cost, you know, that's the way our health system works. If you have private health insurance and you don't want to go through Medicare, I really wanted to choose a very good specialist. And the other things that help, pelvic physiotherapy, like finding a good women's health physio was, just as amazing as finding the really good gynecologist. She has helped me. But that's not covered on Medicare and not covered really. My health fund gives a tiny back. But that's also been really helpful, because what happens with endo and other diseases of the pelvis is that the pain signals tell the muscles of the pelvis to tighten up. It's kind of a protective impulse. So they become very, very tight. And over time, all the muscles around my pelvic floor and pelvis had become so tight that they didn't know how to relax. So all these stabbing pains that I was getting and sudden pains that would just shoot up, you know, very your internal organs, were because of those muscles. And, you know, you can't fix that at surgery. I had to train them over many months to learn how to relax. And that's expensive.
So you've spent basically the equivalent of a house deposit on your own health.
In the last 6 years.
In the last 6 years. Mm. If we look nationally, how much does the Australian government spend on endo treatment and research compared to other chronic health conditions?
It's minuscule. Look, it's very hard to get good treatment under Medicare. And a lot of women really suffer and they're told, we can't help you. But there are good treatments out there. It's just, look, our health system is not set up to deal with chronic health conditions, especially chronic pain conditions. And Medicare really doesn't prioritise the treatment of women's health. It's really poorly rewarded. And it often means that doctors who treat women with these conditions and treat them well lose money sometimes. They have to have other things that they do in order to stay afloat.
Is it known yet if endometriosis affects a woman's fertility?
So there's conflicting things, but it does, yes. About a third of women with endometriosis will have fertility issues. There's a lot of good IVF doctors now working in that area who can help.
I had a friend with endo who was told by a GP that she should get pregnant and that would help relieve the symptoms of endo.
Yeah, look, that's a very, very common myth. A lot of doctors are still saying that, and I'm so surprised. Having a baby does not cure your endometriosis. Sometimes it can get worse after giving birth. There are a lot of women with endo who don't have any trouble falling pregnant, and that's great, but it doesn't solve their problems. But, you know, this has been something doctors have told women since the beginning of time. Oh, just get pregnant, it'll solve everything.
Well, you first started getting symptoms, as you say, as a teenager, but didn't get a diagnosis until 23. Why does it take women so long often to get a diagnosis of endometriosis?
Because society has a problem listening to women. And so, of course, doctors...
Really, though, in a GP's room, if I go in and tell my doctor, look, I'm in terrible pain, I'm throwing up, I'm every month, I'm leaving my job, I can't... A GP would listen to that.
A lot of them do. Look, I think most doctors go into medicine because they want to help people, right? I don't think any doctor is satisfied when they can't help their patients. But there's centuries of myth about women being exaggerators and attention seekers. But there's also this idea that women are just born to suffer, that pain is normal for women. That's just part of their lot and they should put up with it. So there are all these issues conspiring to make a woman's report of her health unbelievable or not believed. The average delay of a diagnosis of endometriosis is between 7 to 12 years. This is borne out by study after study after study.
If a woman is coming to a doctor and describing symptoms, which it turns out are around endo, the extreme fatigue and severe pain, if a doctor is not aware of endo or doesn't make that connection, what do those symptoms and a woman returning to describe those symptoms, what can a doctor often attribute them to?
Well, often they're told it's a mental problem. You're like you have some kind of PTSD or other words that they use for hysterical. Just can't cope with life. Too anxious about your health is a really common.
Is this something doctors say explicitly?
Yes.
To women?
Yes. I mean, look, there are a lot of great doctors out there, I've got to say, and many doctors will listen to you and believe you. But also, they come from a profession which has ignored women's pain since the beginning of the profession.
Is there also a kind of frustration, perhaps, if you were a GP and your job, as you see it, is to cure someone and someone keeps coming back and you don't know what it is? It's like maybe you think, well, maybe it is just in their mind. I'm using all of my medical expertise and I can't solve it, so maybe the problem's inside their head.
That's exactly what happens. You know, it's really, being a doctor is a really hard job and it's not an exact science. So doctors draw on what they've been taught. They haven't been taught much about women's pain, but a lot of doctors will listen and will care and they'll try everything they know. And sometimes, you know, the pain gets fixed and they think, that's great. But then the woman has five other symptoms. You know, she has irritable bowel syndrome or painful bladder syndrome. She has migraines and this fatigue and the kind of dizziness. And they're really common symptoms of endometriosis and other chronic pain conditions. And then so that's when the doctor starts saying, what? Well, I fixed your pain. You said the pain was the worst thing. You know, it must be you.
Do doctors sometimes think or is there an assumption that it's certain personalities?
Type A personalities.
Type A.
Yeah. That's a really big one that we got told. I've been told by hundreds of women, they've been told that.
What's that connection meant to be?
Oh, you're just a very uptight person. And this is often something, this is what rich women are told, right? Poor women are told they're drug seekers. There's a real class issue here too. It's that just keeps showing up in not just people, what people are telling me, but in studies, like people have studied this. So yeah, it's really these stereotypes of women just come out and they often don't come out at first. That's not the first thing doctors fall back on, but once they've tried everything and it doesn't work, then these things start to come up.
Being in chronic pain, especially if you don't have a diagnosis or aren't getting any treatment, it couldn't help but start to affect a person's mental health and mood. I mean, there must be huge instances of depression and distress connected
exactly.
with this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I often say that kind of medicine has been gaslighting women for centuries, because what happens is you're in pain all the time. We know literature proves that there's a link between pain and depression and anxiety. So you go to a doctor, they don't believe you. You go to another one, they don't believe you. You go to another one and you're so angry that then you become the hysterical woman they told you were in the first place, because being in pain constantly drives you crazy, especially when people aren't believing you. So, you know, it is this weird loop.
You talk about the way women's bodies have been looked at over medical history. How has the uterus, the womb, the sort of the big symbol that separates women's bodies from men's bodies, how is that understood in medical history?
So that's been considered the cause of all female illness. So women have been men, but with wombs. So all these things that go wrong with women are all to their wombs. Then when kind of the endocrine system was discovered, it became their raging hormones. So, you know.
And the womb was meant to wander about,
oh, yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, the wandering womb.
Plato even wrote about that.
Yes, and some other doctors characterised it as an animal within an animal, and it would wander around sucking all the energy out of women. It was this voracious animal that would sap every woman's appetite and energy.
What kind of treatments used to be prescribed for wandering wombs and nervous women?
Bandage very tightly the abdomen. They would put nice smelling herbs at the vulva to, like, this is basically what vaginal steaming is today.
This is Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah.
This is great.
I know. So many of her things draw on the things that were, like, discredited in Roman times.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski on ABC Radio.
What about hysteria? Because if women now in 2019 are going into doctors and being told, hey, this is all in your head, we can't help you, these symptoms, what's the history of physical symptoms being ascribed to a woman's psychology, her emotions? How does hysteria figure in this story?
Hysteria is a big part of medical history, and this is something that I spent a lot of time investigating and looking back on, because I was kind of surprised to see that it still happens in a way. And
when were women first diagnosed with hysteria?
Hysteria comes from Hippocrates' time. Since ancient times, women have been diagnosed with hysteria, but it kind of went through different phases. It reached its peak in Victorian times, where women were presenting with kind of chronic pain and kind of spasms and muscle loss function and things like that.
And that continued up until when did that stop being taken seriously?
The early 20th century, it stopped. And Freud kind of was the first person to say it's all in the mind. For a long time, there could be no distinction between kind of illnesses of the body and mind. That's a really new thing in medicine. But women were kind of just thought to be kind of exaggerators. And there's this history of doctors talking about their hysterical patients in really cruel terms, and like they're just attention seekers. They get attention at home for being sick, and that's why they put on this kind of malingering behaviour.
I guess that for centuries, doctors have tried to understand bodies without the kind of scientific research that's available now. So if we jump forward to now, surely doctors have a much more nuanced understanding of a woman's biology, physiology. It must be a completely different picture now than it had been.
Well, that's what you would think, right? But the remarkable lack of curiosity medical science has shown in female biology is absolutely astounding. And that's one of the most shocking things that played out to me when I was writing this book, that there has everything about a woman has been the difference in her womb and hormone system. But they actually haven't studied. They've just thought a woman is a man with a womb, as I said before. But now we're starting to understand that women have different symptoms in all kinds of illnesses, even those that are experienced by both sexes. But they just don't know.
Well, what's the history of the way females have been used in clinical trials?
So they weren't even included in clinical trials until the 1990s.
1990s?
I mean, they were used to experiment on, let me tell you, in the most gruesome ways, but weren't really studied.
What was that? What was the rationale for not...
So, the rationale appears to be quite good. So, the women's menstrual cycle might interfere with the results.
Which is so bizarre, isn't it?
Because you would think you would need to know that,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. It's like saying, I want to study the universe, but that's too big, so I'm just going to study a potato.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if you're studying a woman's body, then the menstrual cycle is going to be a factor
exactly.
in that. So they say, we'll study a man instead because he doesn't have a menstrual cycle.
They even studied man in terms of if estrogen protects against heart disease.
What?
I mean, it is so ridiculous if you look back at the way these things have been studied.
And this is up until the 1990s.
Up until the 1990s. And the other reason they gave was because because, so women are born with all the eggs we'll ever have, unlike sperm, which reproduces constantly in a man. And so they said, oh, well, we don't want to ruin her chances of reproductive success, so we won't study her. But
because what if we're studying maybe a medicine or a drug, it might affect her fertility.
Yes, okay. Exactly. So that you know, that kind of makes sense. But there's a lot of ways, you know, to study women, you know, who are past that. And anyway, they do to test on them because they sell them the drugs in the end.
Sell them, right? But just have never tested them, yeah, on female populations.
And between 1997 and 2000, of the 10 drugs that were taken off by the FDA because of severe adverse effects, 8 had more severe adverse effects in women. So there are consequences.
And they wouldn't have known that because they didn't study women in trials.
They didn't study them in the first place.
So are we just talking about human subjects?
No, we're also talking about preclinical studies. They don't even study female rodents. I mean, this is changing, I've got to say. But, you know, if we just look at pain, for example, we know that 70% of people with chronic pain conditions are women. 80% of pain medication currently available has been tested on men, human men, or male rodents. And they say the same thing. Oh, we can't study female rats because the estrus cycle might interfere with our results. But some studies have shown that actually it doesn't interfere with results. And if you're studying a condition which mainly affects women, then the best rodent model is a female.
Are medical students aware of this, you know, hopefully increasingly historical bias in the way studies have been done?
Some younger doctors have been in touch with me to tell me that they are starting to learn about the bias of medical knowledge. But certainly a lot of doctors up until very recently were never told about this kind of bias. And it plays out in all sorts of, not just in pain conditions, but in heart disease and in strokes and in all sorts of things. We now know that men and women have different symptoms of heart attack, for example, which, you know, up until 10 years ago wasn't really widely acknowledged.
And that has results in different survival rates.
A study last year showed something like, this may not be exactly right, but it's like half the women presenting with a heart attack would be treated fully, and they were twice as likely to die 6 months after that admission. And that's in Australia. And this is in tertiary important hospitals, this is happening. So women are still being undertreated for heart disease and heart attack symptoms and are still dying.
And that's
because of that lack of treatment.
And they're presenting with different symptoms,
yeah,
than men would.
But also, not all men have the typical, quote-unquote, male symptoms. So by understanding, you know, the difference in human symptoms, we help everyone. So a lot of men who present with these atypical, only they're not atypical for half the population, but anyway, I won't get bogged down in that, who present with these so-called atypical symptoms are not treated well either.
Endo is a chronic pain condition as opposed to the sort of pain you experienced when you had your skiing accident or your train accident, which is acute pain. What different things are happening in our body with those different kinds of pain? Do medical researchers know much about that?
So, yeah, they know a lot about acute pain, and that's the pain that you have when you break a bone or there's tissue damage of some kind. And medicine is pretty good at treating that pain. Chronic pain medicine acknowledges itself that it doesn't know enough about. And they now understand that it works in the central nervous system and is perceived in the brain. And so they're right at the beginning of studying chronic pain, where we've known a lot about acute pain for centuries.
So does pain always, does a doctor think that pain always has to result from there being an injury or a disease to make pain happen?
Yeah, so traditionally that's what has been believed. There has to be some biological cause, some tissue damage or some problem somewhere in the body to be causing pain. And that's what doctors always look for. And that's why they give up on the chronic pain patients, because some do a lot of investigations and they can't find that root cause. But now scientists and doctors know that there doesn't actually have to be an original organic problem, that other things could be triggering this chronic pain, which is a sensitization of your central nervous system.
You went and met with a pelvic pain expert, Dr. Susan Evans. What diagram did she draw for you, Gabrielle, to explain
the most amazing
how
woman.
This works?
She's a gynecologist, a pain physician. She's now a researcher, and she drew this amazing diagram of the female reproductive organs, and she was it's showing me the, you know, you have pain signals that go up from the brain, and they might start with period pain, for example. And then you have these other pain signals that come down, and they're the good signals. They're the things that tell you, oh, you don't need to feel that little bit of fluid in the bladder yet. You don't need to feel that until it's full and you need to go to the toilet. You don't need to feel every part of the digestive process in your bowel. You don't need to feel the muscles that are sitting on that chair. And what happens in chronic pain is those signals get lost somehow. They get messed up. So people with chronic pain start to feel more pain, and they start to feel pain, you know, without any kind of trigger, for example.
So it's so fascinating. So it's not that it's just in your head.
No.
It's in your body, but it's like your body's gone into a inflammation, or it's triggering itself even when there's not an external stimulus.
Yeah, that's right. And so sometimes, you know, doctors have been traditionally, you know, love to do a hysterectomy when there's a woman in pain, and then they'll think it's proof it's in her head, because I've taken her uterus out and she still has this pain. But if her central nervous system has already been sensitized, the removal of the uterus won't always remove all her other symptoms. And I've had a lot of women contact me who have had hysterectomies who are still having all these other symptoms, and that's quite frustrating.
How can people go about trying to, you know, untrigger a central nervous system that's become so sensitized to pain? How can that be reversed?
There's some drugs and treatments that are helpful with that. And, you know, Australia is really lucky to have people like Susan Evans, and we have a college for pain medicine called the Faculty of Pain Medicine. So there's a lot of research going on. But there are some simple things we can do. There's just a very cheap drug called amitriptyline, which was first used for anxiety and depression. They don't usually use it for that anymore. They use it for chronic pain patients. Mainly, that works in a lot of people. Pain psychology can help, regular exercise, and that this loosening of the muscles, but not too intense exercise, I've got to say that. Good sleep, you know, no stress, all these things can help pain.
It's much more complex a response than just writing a prescription or doing a surgery, though,
isn't
it?
It's really hard. Yeah, it's hard work for doctors, and especially, as I said, when our system doesn't actually reward doctors for doing that kind of work.
We've focused on endometriosis as a chronic pain condition that 1 in 10 women, I think, worldwide experience. What are the other pain conditions that are usually found in women?
Yeah, so I discovered that there are these 10 what they call overlapping pain conditions, that once a woman gets one, she starts to pick up others, and that a lot of these conditions also overlap with autoimmune conditions. So endometriosis is one of these 10 pain conditions. Vulvodynia is another, irritable bowel syndrome and painful bladder syndrome, migraines, temporomandibular joint disorders, which is jaw pain, chronic tension type headache, low back pain, fibromyalgia, and chronic fatigue syndrome.
Do we know what it is about women's bodies that make them more susceptible to those conditions?
So this is an area of research that's happening. I'm really grateful to say that it's still at the beginning. There are some theories that the fact of having period pain might set up the conditions for chronic pain to develop later in life. So telling girls that their period pain is normal and that they have to put up with it could potentially be very dangerous.
Is there something about the differences in the immune systems between men and women that also factor in here?
Yes, there must be. And again, this is another area of interesting research that it's at the beginnings. But some pain scientists that I spoke to really do believe there's something in the innate immune system and how that works with inflammation that is causing it to be more prevalent in women. You know, this is a really interesting area of research that I think needs to be pursued.
How does what you're saying, Gabrielle, fit with all the statistics that say women live longer than men? Doesn't that mean we're healthier?
Well, that is a very interesting question, Sarah, because yes, women live longer, but we live fewer active years than men now. This is something that's just happened. And there's this adage in medicine that goes, men die quicker, women are sicker. And that's because medicine does understand that women have slightly different immune systems. We produce more antibodies. This protects us. So women survive infections that would kill men. And this is evident right from the fetus. So premature baby girls fare much better than premature. And it goes right through life. But that's also why we have more we're more susceptible to autoimmune conditions. More women get them. When men get them, they tend to be much more severe because their immune systems are slightly different.
You were talking about the fact that it is important for, say, teenage girls to understand what's normal and what's not, say, when it comes to period pain. Is there still a lot of aversion or ignorance in talking about menstruation and body type and body parts? I mean, did you discover that when you were researching this? Are women still ourselves ignorant about what's going on?
We are, and that's deliberate. And what I realised in my research that this really plays into our sicknesses and our illnesses and why we're more likely to be disabled than men of the same age, why we have more chronic pain illnesses. Because we can't talk about our what's hurting and where the pain is, if we don't understand the parts of our anatomy and how they feel and what they're called. You know, I spoke to doctors who said that women come in and say, oh, I have pain during sex. Oh, where does it hurt? Down there. They don't know. They can't explain it. They don't know the words. And one doctor said she'd talked to a woman for 10 minutes who was talking about her waterworks, and she thought she was talking about her bladder, and then realised she was reporting gynecological symptoms. And, you know, this can't help us, can it?
Even the word vagina is a word that many women still are confused about, which is extraordinary. Mm. I mean, you can't imagine that they're being equivalent with men.
No, exactly. And I mean, the thing is, you know, men are lucky. It all hangs out there. They see it all. They, you know, see other men in the urinal. I don't know if they look or not. But, you know, you can't help seeing it all. But for women, a lot of it's inside, and it's also between our legs. And there's this shame that is built into us about touching and looking. And so it is a bit harder for us.
And there is still this ick factor around women's bodies.
Yeah.
This week we've seen all these complaints around a television advertisement that showed menstrual blood. Other blood from other parts of the body, that's fine.
Yeah.
But not menstrual blood.
I know, it's bizarre. But this is really instrumental in the subordination of women, I think. The making everything about that happens to a woman shameful and embarrassing to talk about.
Last year, the American actress and writer Lena Dunham went public with her experience of endometriosis. What kind of effect did that have?
Look, she's been really instrumental in raising awareness of endometriosis, and I think that it's great that she's done that. But, you know, it does open her up for a lot of criticism too, because people think, again, she's an attention seeker, you know, maybe she gets something wrong and then, you know, she's piled on for that. But the great news is that endometriosis in the last 5 to 10 years has received a lot more attention, and that is a really good thing. And Australia is really leading the way in that. I mean, Greg Hunt has really listened to women advocates around the country and to doctors and to researchers, and he's developed this National Action Plan for Endometriosis, which is brilliant. It's a really good plan.
What does it suggest, or what are the structures that it's implementing?
It is looking at some of the things we've talked about, like how Medicare undervalues the treatments. It's trying to do something about that.
And that's because, simply that Medicare doesn't want doctors to spend too much time with patients? Is that at heart?
Medicare is set up that to treat acute problems. People are sick, you get them better and they move on. It's really not working for chronic illness at the moment, and that's acknowledged. I think that, you know, a lot of people are talking about that, and that's something that has to change, but change is slow.
And is there more funding coming from the government?
So there's more funding coming for endometriosis. They're looking at standardising surgery so that, you know, people aren't having 13 surgeries that don't work. You know, there's an education aspect of it in schools. They're actively looking at how to reduce the costs for the treatments that are evidence-based that work. So there's a lot of great things in that plan. And I think Australia is really showing the rest of the world how it can be done.
Do you think there could one day be a cure?
Absolutely. You know, just do some research into it. You know, I think that the money that has come is great. It's nowhere near enough. We really need to go back to basic science, to looking at the mechanisms at play in endometriosis and these other chronic pain conditions, and to really look at the immune system and what it's doing in terms of inflammation and things like that. That's where people are telling me we need to really be concentrating. And that involves not just focusing on endometriosis. The thing that doctors like about endo is that it can be seen. There is a physical, organic aspect to it. They can open up your pelvis and they can look with a camera inside and they can see these deposits and they think, well, that's all it is. But there's a lot of chronic pain without endo, and those women tend to get treated fairly poorly. Mm. And studies are showing that the severity of the physical lesions and disease don't always correlate with the severity of symptoms. So a lot of women can come in with a lot of pain, a lot of other symptoms, you know, this fatigue and the headaches and the anxiety and the bad sleep and nausea, and they'll get go to a surgery and there won't be that much disease, and then they're kind of told, well, it must be all in your head.
When you wrote that article in 2015, Gabrielle, I think that really helped open up a conversation here in Australia. And have you looked at, I mean, are there other, the way that other diseases or conditions have been able to push back against a taboo? I'm thinking obviously of AIDS, but also things like breast cancer. Yeah. They were sort of hush-hush for a long time. Mm. So what have you and other workers on endo seen and can take from the way other conditions and diseases have changed their public perception?
It usually comes from amazing advocacy work from patients and their allies. And there's always, you know, there's always doctors on the inside who really want to change things, who team up with these advocates in the best possible ways. And, you know, women were once told that breast cancer was a career woman's disease, that it was a lifestyle disease, it was because you delayed childbirth, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was the work of people who had survived and their family and friends and doctors and scientists who said, no, we need more research into this. And, you know, it was the same with AIDS. You know, they thought that was the incurable disease. That was the work of tireless work of advocates.
How are you managing your disease now in terms of the pain that you were racked with in your 20s and 30s? Has that eased off?
Yeah, look, I feel really lucky that I am not only able to work a full-time job but to write a book as well. I know for so many women with chronic pain and with all the best treatments could never achieve that. So I feel really lucky. I have an excellent GP. She is brilliant. I have a fantastic gynecologist who sadly just resigned, but his wife is an amazing gynecologist too, so that's lucky.
And for you, it's been a suite of behaviours, yes, and medical interventions.
Exactly.
That are what are
it's
helpful.
Lots of different things. You know, I take a pain drug, I take a hormonal contraception, I do physiotherapy, I do yoga, I try to get 8 hours sleep every night. Not the same thing will work for every woman. That's the thing. It's a real individual's disease.
What kind of reaction have you had to the book so far?
Oh, it's been overwhelming. I'm kind of blown away by how positive it's been. So many women have talked to me, told me their stories. Oh, so many women tell me, I've cried because it's like you're describing my life. But I have to say, so many doctors have been getting in touch with me to say thank you, especially female doctors, some male doctors too. You know, male doctors are great too, but they want change. They want the tools to be able to help their patients. It's incredibly frustrating to not be able to help people who come to see you, and they are really glad this conversation is going out into the public so they can, you know, also say, this, we need more information on this. And the other thing I'll say is scientists. A lot of scientists have been putting in grants for research money time after time. But because we know so little about pain, it doesn't kind of tick the boxes that research grants often ask for.
It's hard to say what results you're aiming for.
Yeah, because you don't know. No two patients are the same. So you can't get a standardised result. And actually, there was a huge study in America about chronic pain called Relieving Pain in America. And one of their recommendations was we need to totally change the research criteria for giving money for pain research because it just doesn't fit.
In that initial article in 2015, you spoke about feeling frightened and vulnerable about putting yourself out there personally in this way. Has your sense of yourself changed since going public with your own endo?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with is, as you raised earlier, I had this idea of myself as a really weak, second-rate person who's a bit wimpy. And confronting that and saying, oh, I'm not a weak person, has been probably the hardest thing that I've had to do. You know, that is still hard. And that's the most emotional part of it, to kind of think a lifetime of thinking about myself in one way is I have to change that. But just people telling me their stories and saying it resonates with them, that's really helping.
I can't imagine weak being an adjective I used to describe you, Gabrielle. But what about, I have to ask, kebabs and the love of kebabs that took you to India and play a pivotal part in this story. Are you still a fan of the kebab?
I am still a massive fan, and that kebab book's still on the back burner.
Where do you get your kebabs now? What's your preferred kebab?
Oh, well, I'm lucky enough to coincidentally have an Iranian partner who makes the most amazing kebabs. And he makes them for me, but there's a few restaurants I like to go to in Sydney in a place called Fairfield that does really good kebabs.
Well, I'm not sure if it helps with the endometriosis, but I'm sure it helps in many other ways anyway. So kebab away.
Yes, thank you.
Really great to speak to you on
Thanks
Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
Gabrielle Jackson has been my guest on Conversations today. Her book is Pain and Prejudice. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.